Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. On our program today, the clean water emergency.
You know, the city of Iqaluit has been under a water crisis for about 5 years. We're going on our sixth year now. We just don't have enough water in our reservoir. Our reservoir is too small for the amount of people.
There's the mayor of Iqaluit on this program last night because Iqaluit is still without clean drinking water as the city investigates a possible petroleum contamination. How long, though, has water security been a problem, and what's the fix for the treatment plant? In moments, we're going to ask that that territory's newest MP. Then, help for Saskatchewan?
They were very welcoming. If we needed any help, they were prepared to do that.
Does the Prairie Province, with the worst COVID conditions, need federal help dealing with COVID? Why are they turning to other provinces like Ontario? Is the province holding back asking the federal government for help for political reasons, or is the system really able to handle the load? We'll ask Saskatchewan's opposition leader on the press gallery to talk about that, plus escaping Afghanistan.
Ms. Baker, this is an extreme environment.
We'll speak to the real-life journalist and the Afghan fixer behind this Hollywood hit movie on the desperate race to evacuate Afghan and including members of his own family. How did the loved ones get out, and what was Canada's role? They are standing by. All that, plus Justin Trudeau is set to announce his new cabinet in late October. We're expecting the 25th or the 26th, but after new controversies keep emerging in the military, does the Prime Minister have to remove his longstanding Minister of Defence? We'll dig into that as well. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. No clean drinking water. $9 for a liter of water at the store. That is the current reality for 9,000 residents in Iqaluit. In a desperate move, the city is forced now to import water by plane. Check this out. A plane from Ottawa, this is it. It's carrying 80,000 liters of clean water to the city today, and residents have been scrambling to get safe drinking water since a state of emergency was declared on Tuesday after a fuel smell was detected in the water treatment plant. Check this out, just unloading water. That's coming from Ottawa to Iqaluit. So how bad is the situation, and how are people coping? We begin our coverage with CTV's Kevin Gallagher. He's in Iqaluit with the latest. Kev, we just saw the pictures of the water arriving. Where is it going?
Well, that's now being distributed to two different sites here in the city of Iqaluit to people that are coming to pick it up. Basically, they're handing out four-liter bottles of water per household. And frankly, the people that were picking it up were very happy to see it. It's been a difficult time, even though it's been just 2 days since the tap shut off. I've talked to other people, Evan, who've been actually going to the river to get their water for days now because of the smell and taste of the water that was coming out of their taps. Of course, this fuel smell that was discovered by, or confirmed, let's say, by city officials when they started to open up this containment tank inside the water treatment facility at the top of the hill in a Iqaluit. Now, this containment tank is supposed to be sealed. Nothing's supposed to get in, so it's a mystery here. They're trying to figure out how this happened. There's plenty of theories, but it's still unknown why there's something that smelled like petroleum inside the water treatment containment tank and how that ended up also avoiding other tests that the city was doing to make sure its water was safe, where people may have been drinking this water coming out of the tap, using and bathing, cooking with it for days before they shut things down.
So let me just get back to the water, how much people are getting, Kev, because, you know, you're recommended to drink, you know, about 2 liters a day for a man. I think it's 1.6 liters for a woman, but call it 2 liters a day. How long is this this amount of water supposed to last people? Are there going to be flights coming in every day?
Well, this is what's being given out to households today. So we're talking about those, you know, that many liters of water. 16 liters of water. So, you know, this is expected to happen again tomorrow. There's three more airlifts of water coming in tomorrow as well. And then another one scheduled for Monday. So by the end of the weekend into Monday, you have 170,000 liters of water coming in to the city. But that's really just to get through the day-to-day here for most people. They are getting water from the river and treating it. There's probably going to be more people that are going to go and get their own water from the river as well and then boil it. So it's certainly not a sustainable situation. They're expecting the results of the water from the treatment facility back within 5 days after they sent it. Now, that was sent in sometime on Tuesday. So they're certainly awaiting those results to see what was in the water and what where it came from. This is the real issue here. They have also asked the federal government for money and the territory of Nunavut to have funding to bypass what they feel may be a contaminated section of the water treatment facility to other parts of that facility that have a holding tank. And then they could start to use the municipal water again from the reservoir. But water's a big issue here all around, Evan. Essentially, the city of Iqaluit gets their water from a lake just on top of a hill above the city. That lake really is not big enough to sustain the population growth that Iqaluit is experiencing. Furthermore, climate change is playing a big role here. The permafrost is melting, and that means that a lot of the infrastructure that's built on top of that permafrost is shifting. That means pipes that are either in the ground or on top of that water, but also the water treatment facility. So this is certainly one of the areas that inspectors and investigators are going to look into to see if that's part of the issue. They're also inspecting that tank for cracks. So all in all, like you say, it comes down to the people here, Evan. You need water to live, and people are not, can't even use this water really to bathe in, especially if they have small kids. So how long can this last? It's certainly not something that a lot of people are hoping lasts long. And actually, when I asked that to a resident who was getting the water that was coming in off the airlift, she said to me, my goodness, this is the first time that I'm really thinking about this. This is simply not something that I think we can keep up. So it's a lot of concern for people who are here waiting to find out what's wrong with the water treatment facility and when they can get a real secure, safe, and sustainable source of water for the long term and what is really the hub of Canada's Arctic.
Yeah, Kevin Gallagher in Iqaluit, in the hub of the Arctic. Kev, thank you so much. Take good care there in a real desperate situation. So how can the federal government help? Well, yesterday on this program, the mayor of Iqaluit told us that he's asking for more than $130 million, as Kevin talked about, to upgrade the treatment plant and the reservoir, which is not big enough to sustain the size of the city. But why has it been left so long, and what should the government do? The newly elected MP for Iqaluit and all of Nunavut is an NDP MP named Lori Idlout. And first of all, congratulations on the win. And I will look forward to seeing you in Parliament. Thank you for being here. What does the federal government need to do to help the situation in Iqaluit?
Thank you so much. I think the federal government has to act faster. I had already started hearing from some of my constituents that they didn't have water jugs to be able to get access to even the river water. So it was very much appreciated when that airlift of water had come in. When I went to check it out, there were a lot of relieved people picking up the limited amount of water that they can have access to. I've been really amazed with how much the community has come together. As you have heard, there's a territorial election going on. Candidates have stopped campaigning so that they can help with distributing water. So it's really good to see everyone coming together, pulling together to make sure that households have access to water that they need.
It just seems that the system's too vulnerable. And I spoke to the Iqaluit Mayor Kenny Bell about this. He said he's asked the government for $133 million to fix the infrastructure. He was saying that they're open to it, but we're in 2021. We're in a tragic, desperate emergency situation there. The reservoir's too small. The treatment plant's too small. Why is it taking so long to get the money and get that fixed for a city of 9,000 people?
I think it's definitely been a frustration for not only Iqaluit residents during my campaign throughout Nunavut. I heard from many other Nunavummiut, Pond Inlet, Iglulik, and just the infrastructure issues that exist for basic needs like proper treatment, water treatment. It's just been challenging to have what I hear from residents is they've been asking for these basic needs, basic infrastructure needs for years, and for them to not be heard has been frustrating. And it's unfortunately taken this kind of crisis to raise more awareness to more Canadians about why Nunavut needs to have increased resources. It takes something like this to raise awareness about how challenging it is to be a smaller jurisdiction, and with such a huge geography. It explains why we can't allow population-based funding to keep operating for Nunavut. We need to make sure that we do better so that we can have Nunavummiut accessing better resources and services from both levels of government.
You can't have people buying water for $9. You can't be flying water in to Iqaluit from Ottawa. It's crazy, and the systems have to be more robust, and it's very urgent. You know, no one needs to live like this in this country. NDP MP elect for all of Nunavut, of course, Lori Idlout. I look forward to you making the trip south and keep raising the issues about Nunavut and about the areas. And again, a pleasure to have you on the program for the first time, but absolutely not the last time.
Thank you so much. I did make out a call to my southern friends. If they want to, they can make donations to a local wellness center here that provides great services. The Tukisigeapik Society here in Iqaluit is a great place that is willing to accept donations of water jugs. You can contact me through social media to find more information so that if you're willing to, you can make at least some donations of water jugs to Nunavummiut, to Iqaluit residents specifically during this time.
Yeah, water jugs. Imagine that. We're talking about donations of water jugs for clean drinking water in Canada. Thank you. I really appreciate that. Absolutely critical issue. Coming up on this program, the desperate push to escape Afghanistan. It's been going on since the Taliban took over, and our next guest works side by side covering the war in Afghanistan. Now they're fighting to get colleagues and loved ones out. There was a feature film starring Tina Fey made about their relationship, but what they've done in the last number of weeks to help get their own family, an own family member out and others, is remarkable. Their story next on Power Play. Welcome back to the program. Their Afghanistan war story got the Hollywood treatment.
Ms. Baker, this is an extreme environment.
I've seen people with actual... Journalist Kim Barker's memoir on reporting in Afghanistan called The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan, was eventually adapted into this movie, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, starring, of course, Tina Fey. But her work could not have been done without what's called her fixer, Dr. Farooq Samim, a former reporter and translator from Afghanistan. Mr. Samim moved to Canada in 2009, but the two have remained close ever since. But now, Kim Barker and Dr. Samim are part of an ad hoc group fighting for people stuck in Afghanistan after the Taliban took over so quickly, including members of his own family, who had to make a harrowing escape recently. So far, the organizations have got about 800 people out of the country. This week, the European Union pledged $1.4 billion Canadian for Afghanistan. The union was the only party to make a monetary pledge at this week's G20 virtual meeting. Is the international community doing enough to avoid a humanitarian crisis, and should Canada specifically be doing more to resettle the 40,000 refugees it's promised? Joining me now to find out are New York Times reporter Kim Barker and the former freelance reporter and translator Farooq Samim, who's in Canada. First of all, a pleasure to have both of you on, and in a situation that we continue to follow. Kim, you and Dr. Samim have been working to resettle your former colleagues from the Chicago Tribune. Can you tell us about when the Taliban took over, the furious work to get them out and the challenges you've had because of the lack of support?
Sure, I can talk about that. Thanks for having us on. I mean, in the beginning, I think all of us were just like the rest of the world. We were stunned by how quickly Kabul fell and how quickly the Taliban took over. I got involved because Farouk called me and he was talking to me specifically about his family members who he was worried about, specifically his disabled sister who was still there, and also our former colleagues with the Chicago Tribune and their families. And so we just started working, and there was no, you had no idea what to do, right? You were sending out emails to the State Department, you know, filling out various forms and manifests and just trying to do anything you could to find somebody, anyone who would help. And it just really came down as the days ticked down towards August 31st and the U.S. and West withdrawal from Afghanistan. It just became very clear that we weren't going to get anybody out anywhere. And it was very frustrating. And it wasn't just us who were doing this. And it wasn't just us who were struggling with this. It was so many ad hoc groups, so many people who really loved Afghanistan and worked there for years, who just couldn't do anything. And there was no path forward with any of the governments to get these folks out.
Yeah, I mean, journalists, workers, veterans, lots of people who work there. Farouk, you had family, as Kim was just talking about, your sister and others, who were left there when the Taliban took over. What was their situation, and how did they get out?
As Kim explained, it was a very, very difficult situation. And in my situation, it started with an afternoon call with a very good friend, a Canadian friend in Ottawa, who put me in touch with two pro bono lawyers, two wonderful, wonderful people from a law firm in Canada, who stepped up and tried to find ways to support my family and ask for their visas. And just to mention that I not only worked with Kim in Afghanistan, but before coming to Canada and after coming to Canada, I served the Canadian forces as well. I trained them here before their deployment in Kandahar, and I covered their stories by being embedded with the forces in the front line, and I have provided written materials to NATO forces when I was in Afghanistan. So that qualified me as one of the people that I could ask for a Canadian visa for my extended families. When this situation happened in Afghanistan and the Taliban took over, it was a shock for everybody. My family was in grave danger because of all my activities with the Canadians as a journalist in serving NATO forces in Afghanistan. So I was desperate for help with these two pro bono lawyers from Gall & Company. Now we call it Project Ibrahim. It started with my family, and it expanded to the 800 people that we coordinated with Kim with and other American friends, great American friends, and we tried to get them out. They went through a lot of difficulties. We were not successful to extract them from Kabul, evacuate them from Kabul. We took this dangerous road to northern Afghanistan, 10 hours by bus, and we put all these 800 people, including my family members, including my disabled sister, we got them to northern Afghanistan, and we worked very, very hard. With the help of generous North American people, Canadians and Americans, we managed to find funds for these charter planes and get them out of Afghanistan. I'm so relieved. I'm so happy that I'm part of this effort with Kim and with other great Canadians and Americans to help those precious lives. And we are still working very, very hard to get more people out.
It's a remarkable story, and we keep covering it. But, Kim, you know what strikes me is the words that we all have used, ad hoc, you, Farouk, other journalists, other veterans. I've spoken to many of them over the last number of months. What about the government? Is the Canadian government, is the U.S. government doing enough to help? There was a summit, a G20 summit, where the Europeans talked about $1 billion, euros, to do something. Are governments doing enough to help?
I mean, I think the answer to that would be looking at who's been left behind and all the Afghans who are still in Afghanistan whose lives are in danger, you know, whether it's the female judges that we're now working to try to get out, or it's SIVs, you know, the folks who qualify for special immigration visas in the U.S. who worked alongside U.S. troops or served directly in the U.S. embassy. I mean, we got some of those folks out on our two planes. You know, we shouldn't be doing that. We shouldn't have to be fundraising to try to get planes of folks out that should have been gotten out in an orderly fashion with the help of Western governments. Because, you know, you can call them SIVs, P2s, all these different applications that people are supposed to do. There are so many people in Afghanistan who really bought into what the West was selling. You know, this idea of democracy, this idea that women could work and become judges and become lawyers and become police officers and run things. And like what has happened recently means that they effectively, not only do they have no life and they're supposed to go back home, but their lives are actually in danger, you know? And I think that governments owe them something, you know, other than just walking away.
Yeah, well, I mean, and Farouk, that has been the key issue. Can you be very specific? You talk about the lawyers who helped you in Canada, the pro bono work. The federal government's response, you know, we've spoken to the immigration minister, we've spoken to the ministers about this. What else can you do? I had the Minister of International Development on the program last night talking about that. In your view, sir, what else should the Canadian government be doing?
I think there is a lot that the Canadian government could do. I'm asking all the governments that they have Afghan allies in Afghanistan still in danger, still in dire situation, to get people out of Afghanistan. My plea to the government of Canada is that we are so grateful for the Canadian as a nation. We're so grateful that we came up with this number of 40,000 Afghans to be accepted as refugees in Canada. But the bureaucracy is still very slow. And I'm working with these two pro bono lawyers from Gall & Company, you know, Jacques and Louis, these two wonderful people, like many Canadians, they have been helping me very, very hard. And I know as an immigration nation, you know, Canada could do a lot. There's a lot of bureaucracy. For example, 3 weeks ago, my disabled sister, my family members, my other family members are still in Doha, and the process is very, very slow, and they are not able to come to Canada. So if there is any way that we could step up a little bit more with this ambition of our prime minister and, you know, remove or loosen up some of the bureaucracy that we have, particularly at the global affairs level and at the Ministry of Immigration and Refugee level, that they should loosen up the bureaucracy and get these people as soon as possible. We do not have time. Even the election should have not been an excuse to slow down the process. It was an emergency situation. We're totally acting differently than the time that we dealt with the emergency situation in Syria. We want to deal with this emergency situation at the same way.
I will say this. I got a note from another contact and a friend of mine working to get out who was in Afghanistan. This was today. Just got a note to say an Afghan family that we know is house hunting in Ottawa. It was a crazy route to get them there. They're doing well. Another family we got out last week should have another one out in a couple weeks, although it takes way too long and there are too many close calls. We're getting these notes every single day. I know you're on the front lines to help. Kim Barker, Farouk and Kim, I both of you are just doing, I know, great work with a huge team behind you. Thanks for telling your story.
It's not a huge team, and that's the problem. You know, it's like when we say ad hoc, it's 20 people, maybe 25, you know?
Well, you're right. And as you say, it's not all a Hollywood remake. It's real life, and it's happening now, and there's lots and lots of stories left to be told. Kim and Farouk, thank you. Please stay in touch, and we enjoyed having you on the program telling this critical story. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, coming up next, battling the COVID fire, can Saskatchewan stamp out a COVID-19 blaze? It has the lowest vaccination rate in the country and a healthcare system that's on the verge of being overloaded. Is the provincial government using every tool available? Do they need help from the federal government? Saskatchewan's opposition leader, Ryan Miley, joins us next on the Press Gallery. Stay with us. Welcome back to the program. The COVID crisis is creating, well, you could call it the COVID solitudes in Canada, parts of the country opening, others still shut tightly and getting worse. For example, on one side of the country, Ontario expected to announce its plan to exit stage three of their reopening plan as early as tomorrow. Well, Quebec is getting ready to open bars and restaurants back to normal hours by November 1st, according to some reports. This, as Quebec says, nurses could lose their licenses if they're not double vaxxed by November 15th. So they are encouraging everyone to get vaccinated and basically taking every means necessary. On another part of the country, circuit breaker restrictions still remain in effect in parts of New Brunswick. But we all know about the situation in Alberta. But now the worst of all for COVID rates is Saskatchewan. It leads the country in per capita COVID-19 cases, has the lowest vaccination rates in Canada. But the Saskatchewan Health Minister, Paul Merriman, today told reporters that the province is still not asking for the federal government to send in the military or military medical staff to help with their overwhelmed hospitals. He claims the Saskatchewan healthcare system currently has enough resources to handle the load, which is curious because that province is also in talks with the Ford government of Ontario to possibly send patients to Ontario hospitals. And there's talk that they may also need the same help from Manitoba. We did ask the health minister from Saskatchewan and the premier, Scott Moe, but their offices declined our request to join on the program. But the press gallery is here with a special guest from Saskatchewan. First, we've got Joyce Napier, our CTV News National Bureau Chief here in Ottawa, Robert Benzie, the Toronto Star's Bureau Chief at Queen's Park, and our special guest is Ryan Miley, Saskatchewan NDP leader, and he also happens to be a physician. So welcome to all of you. Dr. Miley, let me just start with you. Can you explain, maybe you can't, I don't know. On one hand, the province of Saskatchewan says we don't need any help from the federal government. We can handle it. On another hand, we're seeing them asking Ontario to get ready. They may need support. In your view, what's the situation and is more help needed?
You know, I wish I could explain that message from the current government, the health minister, but it's not logical. We heard yesterday from the head of our health authority, the head of our emergency response team, that we are days away from sending patients to Ontario, that we're days away from implementing ethical triage, that situation where physicians would be put in the position none of us ever want to be in, deciding who gets life-saving care and who doesn't. And the following day, you've got the Minister of Health saying, we're fine, we can handle this. The truth is, we need the help. The leadership within the healthcare field have made it clear. We need the support from the federal government. It is politics that is getting in the way from the minister, from the premier accepting that help.
What do you mean by politics?
They're dealing with their own internal battles. The Buffalo Party, which is sort of the local version of the PPC on the right, they're not wanting to take the steps and show the courage to get things under control. And so they're putting politics ahead of people's lives.
My God. Joyce, what do you make of that? The federal government can't send help to Saskatchewan unilaterally. The province has to ask for it first. What do you make of the fact that, again, lowest vaccination rates, a hospital system on the brink, and you got the opposition leader said politics is in the way?
Well, isn't politics always a little bit in the way? You know, we try to ask the doctors to separate the science from the politics the way we try to separate politics from religion. And sometimes it's very difficult to do. You know, the asking the federal government for help is a bit like, you know, pleading guilty. Well, somewhere along the line, there was a failure there. Either to convince people to get vaccinated, to push people to get vaccinated. And, you know, it is the triage question that the opposition leader just mentioned now that is the most worrisome, who lives and who dies. And all those people waiting in, you know, all those people waiting for treatment, for surgery out there, which is the untold story. And the story that we don't talk about, because all we're doing is we're concentrating on those people with COVID who get to hospital who are unvaccinated. But there is a whole other story out there that politicians dare not talk about, because if they do, then it speaks to the failure of the political failure and also the failures of our healthcare system.
Yeah, Benz, let me talk to you. A, Ontario may be stepping up. I don't know if you've heard any news if they're going to step up to help Saskatchewan. But you know, what do you make of the fact that, you know, Ontario's opening, Saskatchewan may need, but they're not, this is a premier that does not seem to want help.
Yeah, it's just, it boggles the mind, Evan. I mean, Premier Doug Ford is a close political ally of Premier Scott Moe. It's probably the premier that he's the closest to of any in the country. And if Saskatchewan needs the help, Ontario has the capacity because we flattened the curve here many weeks ago. We have about 150 people in ICU with COVID-19 in Ontario, and we have the capacity for 2,300. So we're in good shape here, and we're in good shape because people in Ontario have gotten vaccinated, and they've always worn their masks indoors. We are at 82% fully vaccinated in this province. Saskatchewan's at 72%, so full 10 full percentage points behind. And the masks. I had a friend who was in Saskatchewan recently and wore her mask, and she was surprised that people were kind of giving her a double take when she had a mask. I mean, that is just not, you're not living in the real world. You're not living in the real COVID world if you're thinking that you're not going to have to take some precautions for your own safety. So I think Ontario will be there to help Saskatchewan, Evan. But you know, Premier Moe has to ask for the help.
Yeah, and Dr. Miley, the military critical care nurses that Alberta asked for have been in the province for about a week. It took days for the Canadian Armed Forces to be deployed to Alberta. The reinforcements from Newfoundland and Labrador finally arrived in Fort Mac. Is, in your mind, two questions. Is Saskatchewan taking a gamble by not preemptively asking for federal assistance? And just on Ben's point there, do you need stricter mask mandates there or vaccine mandates to increase the vaccination rate?
Now, I'll just step back a second to Joyce's comments about the failure that has to be admitted. And that's that this summer, the premier basically gave up. He said that the fight was over and that we could move on, eliminated mask mandates, refused any discussion of vaccine mandates, and so really created the conditions for the worst fourth wave in the entire country. And it's really important what she's pointed out, that you know, we're not able to deal with COVID care, but we're also seeing our organ transplant system shut down, cancer surgeries being canceled, care for kids, that essential, crucial, timely developmental care so that kids with developmental challenges can learn to walk and speak is being canceled, so that the same people, the professionals who should be doing that work, can be doing test and trace to try to respond to the overwhelming waves of COVID-19. We failed this summer because the premier gave up. Now he refuses to admit that failure, and so we're missing the opportunity to get ahead in the response. And it's absolutely crucial that we be asking the federal government to help. I've spoken to folks at the federal level. They have told the province what's available. Everything from help with test and trace all the way to setting up field hospitals, that help is there. We should be asking for it, and to not do so in a way that's endangering people's lives is you know, political malpractice on a fatal scale.
Political malpractice on a fatal scale. Joyce, you know, it is fascinating, and you wonder how Scott Moe explains that to the people of Saskatchewan. Again, they say, well, we're just at capacity, but you know, at capacity with COVID, as Dr. Miley says, the knock-on consequences for other medical procedures is massive.
Absolutely, and that is one thing that politicians are not talking about. Doctors are talking about it. Doctors are bringing out the fact that there is going to be triage. It is already happening. So people who have refused vaccines, some legitimately, they have questions, they have fears. I feel for people who have, you know, fears or genuine concerns about the consequences of vaccines. We can't ignore that. But there are a lot of people who think, I don't need the vaccine. I don't need what the government or science to tell me what to do. And the minute they get sick, guess what? They go towards the science. They come to the hospitals. That's where they go. So you're going to have to choose. The doctors in those hospitals are going to have to choose between the cancer patient and the patient who hasn't had a COVID vaccine and, you know, who is in the ICU. There is going to be a time, if these politicians don't get their act together and don't face the reality and ask for the help they need and, you know, free those ICU beds for other patients, but COVID patients, yeah. There will be a crisis in this country in certain areas, Saskatchewan being one of them. Yeah. New Brunswick, again, they canceled Thanksgiving. Even those who were fully vaccinated couldn't get together. Went medieval on the province, but maybe that was the way for him to flatten the curve. That took political courage.
All right, I got to leave it there because we got to jump next door to Alberta. Dr. Dina Henshaw is talking about what's going on. So first, I want to thank the NDP leader in Saskatchewan, Dr. Ryan Miley. Thank you, sir. I know Joyce and Benz are going to stick around. Let's jump next door to Saskatchewan, to Alberta, and find out the latest in that province. Here's Dr. Dina Henshaw.
However, I first want to apologize to the family of the 14-year-old whose death I spoke about on Tuesday. The pain of losing a child is terrible enough without having that loss compounded by a public debate about the circumstances. I am sorry if the way that I spoke about that death made your grief worse. Since the start of this pandemic, I have heard from many Albertans, including those who have lost a loved one. I reflect often on the impact that our reporting, measures, and every other element of the pandemic response has on them. When I speak about cases and our reporting process, it is not to diminish the losses, whether caused by COVID or anything else. At the same time, we are in a global pandemic. We have an obligation to monitor and report deaths from COVID-19 infection and to be as timely and transparent as possible. In our reporting, we always include all deaths that have COVID as either a primary or secondary cause of death, according to the healthcare teams that were involved in the cases. For example, a primary cause would be someone in whom COVID infection progresses to pneumonia, and this is the direct cause of death. A secondary cause could be a case where someone with a severe underlying illness, such as heart failure, gets COVID, and the infection makes their pre-existing condition worse, leading to death. We report in this way to accurately capture the impact that COVID-19 is having. That is also why our reporting process includes both deaths that come to us where a person has COVID listed as a primary or secondary cause of death, as well as cases with a recent diagnosis of COVID where the cause of death is still under investigation. To make sure we are as accurate as possible, after a death is reported, if there is uncertainty, it is reviewed to validate our information. If that review identifies that COVID was not a primary or secondary cause of death, it is removed from our totals. Every surveillance system has to balance this tug of war between precision and timeliness. The more precise reporting is, the slower it is. We have chosen to focus on being as timely as possible in the interests of transparency. Sometimes, though, as in the case reported on Tuesday, the initial information provided to us changes after a review. While the initial report of the death of the 14-year-old included COVID as a secondary cause, we have now received additional information that indicates COVID was not a cause of death. As we routinely do with all similar reviews, when this happens, we remove the death from our reporting. This incident has caused suffering for many, and again, I apologize for this. We are making changes to prevent similar situations in the future. Going forward, we will not publicly report any COVID deaths in anyone under 18 until a review process has been completed. We will prioritize accuracy over timeliness in these cases. I want to assure everyone that these reviews are always done in cases of any uncertainty, so the overall COVID numbers we have been reporting are as accurate as possible. However, it is clear that we need a different process for young people, and we have put that in place now. Again, I offer my sympathies to everyone who has suffered loss from any cause. As I have said many times, every life matters and every death matters.
This is Dr. Dina Henshaw. Two things. She just apologized for reporting that the tragic death of a 14-year-old was COVID-related, now saying it's not, and apologizing for the family on that, saying how horrific it was to compound the tragedy of the death of a child by debating the cause of death publicly. They're going to redo how they calculate COVID-related deaths. Again, new cases in Alberta now stand at 916 new cases today. I'll just give you, you might wonder, is that big or not? Ontario had 417 cases, and it's up in Ontario. So Ontario, with a population of 12, 13 million, now, less than half of what Alberta has. Meantime, we have a CTV News exclusive now. Canada's top military commander, currently on leave, is speaking to CTV News for the first time on camera about the misconduct allegation that sidelined his career shortly after he took the top job. The investigation has ended and no charges were laid, so now Admiral Art MacDonald wants the job of Chief of the Defence Staff back. Here's what he told CTV.
I have not done anything wrong. I've acted with integrity in response to allegations. I've been exonerated as a result of a rigorous and thorough investigation. And I remain a real champion of culture change. I'm committed to it. And I think that by advocating for my job, what I'm saying is simply that, listen, we can't have a system where allegations alone are sufficient for removing someone.
So that is Art MacDonald, the admiral who took over from General Vance, who's also under investigation, though he denies that. You can see that interview of Admiral Art MacDonald, who wants his job back, tonight on CTV National News. It's an exclusive interview, and you should check that out. But the Department of National Defense says the incoming commander of Canada's Army is under investigation now by the military police. Lieutenant General Trevor Cadieu is scheduled to take over his new position on September 7th. A spokesman for the defense, Minister Harjit Sajjan, says, quote, the minister was made aware of an investigation on September 5th. As the investigation is ongoing, it would be inappropriate for us to comment any further. In a statement, Cadieu says, the allegations are false, but they must be investigated thoroughly to expose the truth. I've already voluntarily provided information to the National Investigative Service, and I continue to await additional opportunities to cooperate fully with their investigation. Meanwhile, he has asked that Acting Chief of the Defence Staff, Wayne Eyre, consider choosing someone else to command the Canadian Army. Remember, he's the Acting Chief of the Defence Staff because the man you just saw, Admiral Art MacDonald, was also under investigation. But now CTV News has learned that a female veteran filed an allegation of sexual misconduct and spoke with the Investigative Service of the Canadian Armed Forces in early September about General Cadieu. Now, this is just the latest in a series of high-profile cases of misconduct allegations in the military, and it follows years of investigations into the culture in Canada's forces. Remember, September 2015, former Supreme Court Justice Marie Deschamps released an explosive inquiry report detailing highly sexualized culture inside the Canadian Armed Forces. It was released a couple of months before the Liberals would take office. 5 years later, after Operation Honor was installed to supposedly stamp out the sexual harassment problem, another former Supreme Court Justice, Maurice Fish, released another report this past spring saying, quote, sexual misconduct in the Canadian Armed Forces remains persistent, preoccupying, and widespread despite the CAF's, Canadian Armed Forces, repeated attempts to address the problem and curb its prevalence. One constant over these 6 years of reported action or lack of action. And by the way, there's another Supreme Court judge doing another investigation into this. But the man in charge this whole time has been Defense Minister Harjit Sajjan. Where does this leave the military right now? And as we now know that the Prime Minister is set to shuffle his cabinet either October 25th or October 26th, can he leave Harjit Sajjan, the defense minister, in charge? The press gallery is back. Joyce Napier, CTV National News Bureau Chief. Robert Benzie from the Toronto Star, Bureau Chief at Queen's Park. Our special guest is Charlotte Duval-Lantoine, a fellow at the Canadian Global Affairs Institute and someone who's worked on this for a long time. Can I just start with you, Charlotte Duval-Lantoine? First of all, what do you make of Art MacDonald wanting his job back? And what these new allegations for another high-ranking officer facing allegations, what does it do to the confidence in leadership?
So the issue with Art MacDonald is going back to a conundrum that the Canadian Armed Forces will have to deal with in the future is what to do when someone is not charged with sexual misconduct, even though there has been allegation. As for Arden McDonald himself, I would disagree with his claims that he's in a position to go back to the role of chief of the defense staff for the simple reason that he was not exonerated. What the CFNIS was saying is that there was not enough evidence to charge him, which is completely different. And second of all, as the top soldier in Canada, any doubt on his ability to lead and on his ability to lead culture change and doing it truthfully and in a genuine fashion is problematic. And a lot of people have lost trust in him. And especially his feeling of entitlement means that a lot of people will think that he's not in a position of going back to this role. Kadir, in the case of Kadir, like from what I'm understanding, it's a historical case. It's going to happen. They're going to have historical case that will trigger new investigations and new allegations against senior leadership. And so it is a consequence of people moving forward and coming forward.
Right. Joyce, new cabinet, October 25th or 26th. What does this mean for Harjit Sajjan, the new defense minister? Can he survive in that job?
Well, you know, I mean, the answer is no. Can he survive in that job? The answer should be no, but the decision will be made by the Prime Minister of Canada. Look, I'm not sure that this changing the culture of the armed forces, whether Canadian or any other country, is even something that you can do in the span of half a generation. I mean, you know, the army being or the armed forces being what they are, I kind of understand, you know, what was just said. What I don't understand is how is it that with an allegation, and this is what Art McDonald was saying, should not be a mere allegation should not be enough to remove someone. That's a fair point. But then the other fair point is a potential victim coming forward, then what do you do with that? So is it mission impossible to, at the same time, remove the alleged or potential aggressor and at the same time respect the victim? So it seems to be two impossible missions that you put together. So should there be a fairer process? I think so. You know, should it be removed from the armed forces and into a civilian body? Maybe. Look, so far there hasn't been any solution. But, you know, once the defense minister has been tarnished, so to speak, by inaction and by whatever has happened in the time of his tenure, sure, he should maybe stay in cabinet, right, but do something else. And they should put someone in cabinet that is a fresh face that can look at this issue and this very difficult problem with a fresh look.
Benz, I got less than a minute for you. What do you make about Harjit Sajjan and the new cabinet? Do they need another minister of defense now?
Yeah, Joyce is right. And I thought it was very interesting today when Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland in Washington was asked, should the new minister be a woman? Her body language suggested that, of course, it should be a woman, even though she said that it should be. It's up to the prime minister, obviously, because he chooses the cabinet. But I think all of the signals that we have seen from the prime minister, from the deputy prime minister, are that the next minister will be a woman. And if nothing else, that'll be an optics change. But I think it would signal a culture change that is desperately needed in the Canadian military. It is actually embarrassing that every time it turns around, there's a new CDS being chosen. And wait a minute, he's under investigation. It's just an awful thing. And I feel for the women who serve this country and do a great job. I mean, it's just a terrible situation.
Right. All right, Joyce, Robert Benzie, and Charlotte Duval-Lantoine, thanks so much for taking the time to talk about this. We really appreciate it. We'll find out what the cabinet shuffle does. That is your Power Play Day in Politics. Thank you for watching. We're back in 23 short hours. Hug your loved ones. See you tomorrow.